All right, good evening, everybody. So we're going to do a little shift in how, I don't have slides, I'm not sophisticated. I'm not going to read anything, so I'm going to just touch on a few points, but I'm going to kind of story tell. So before I begin, I want to thank Roger and Winnie and Jeremy for allowing this opportunity to be here today to present. So I'm born in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So like your grandparents, my grandfather moved to the Congo from Gujarat, India. My mom's also born in Tanzania, so we're actually Indian immigrants. I was raised in Belgium. The head office was in Belgium, so I was raised there. Then I finished my schooling in Canada, and then went to university in the US, to UPenn, the Warren School, with some of Roger's nieces and nephews. And
wife.
And then I worked in investment banking for a couple of years in New York, and then moved to Hong Kong in 1992. Now I'm going to share my story, and I'm going to kind of touch on a lot of the stuff that Winnie talked about, but from a personal story and from the business I run today. So my father in 1986 had a heart attack, and in 88 there was, at that point, very soon there was a hostile takeover of his company within the family. And he asked us at that time, and he said, do you want to come back? And we said, we'd rather raise our children and our families in the first world or the quasi-first world. So whatever decision you make, make it for your generation. Don't make it with at least your sons into account. So at that point, he took the position he did, understanding that we don't want to go back to the Congo. And so worked in New York, and then the Berlin Wall fell, and we were looking for frontier markets. So when I say we, I mean my brother, my cousin brother and I decided, let's go into Eastern Europe, what was called Eastern Europe, today Central Europe. So we started our own brand of clothing in that region, and I moved to Hong Kong in 1992 to set up, quote unquote, the buying office, to do all the buying, which was coming mainly out of China. And at the same time, since I was here, I said, we know Africa, as in my dad knows Africa well. I went on a little trip with my dad to the various sub-Sahara, means equator and down countries, visited some of the large families, and decided to start trading in sub-Sahara Africa. So we started with our own brand of clothing, we're trading, and then the Asian crisis happened, and with the financial meltdown, we had a very serious impact economically. And then 1999, we kind of did introspection and reflection. And in 2000, we decided to go back to Africa, but on the condition nobody goes to live there. And we decided to go to very challenging countries. So we went back to the Congo, which, as you know, is a nice civil war-infested country. We went to Angola. We went to Sudan. We went to Burundi. So all the countries that you saw, well, I mean, you guys are much younger, so that Roger used to watch on CNN, we were there. So I remember sitting with the HSBC head of commercial banking, said, how do you choose your countries? I said, it's actually really simple. He's like, okay, this is gonna be crazy, right? Six people at the table. I go, it's simple. The bigger hole, the more to fill. And he's like, okay. And luckily he sanctioned the new finance facility that I asked for. And that was the reality. Our mission statement was to take to the third world what the first world took for granted. So in Eastern Europe, we became the largest licensees to Disney and Warner Brothers with a very simple motto, is that we are only going to add the royalty fee to the cost to the selling price of our existing product. Because the kid that watches television, right, Disney, Warner, etc., should be able to afford the Disney, and not only the kid who can afford the $25, $30, $40, $50 t-shirt. And so we took it in clothing, home textiles, bags, you name it, the whole region. Then in Africa, we brought the likes of Procter & Gamble, Gillette, Reckitt Benckiser, Wrigley's, Mars, Ferrero Rocher, Perfetti, into these countries and became distributors. So things that we take for granted, some of you who shave, right? Disposable razor, sanitary pad, diapers, the basics for us were not basics then, for them. Then we represented Haier, the white goods player out of China. We were the first ones in antiretroviral, which is anti-HIV drugs out of India, $1 a day, and we traded in commodities, right? So now, by the age of 35, I'm thinking my shit doesn't stink. I'm running a business in the hundreds of millions. We've got office seven countries on the ground in Africa, five in Eastern Europe, buying office in Hong Kong, Dubai, Paris, you know. We're doing great, 10,000 employees. And then I get diagnosed with stage 3 cancer. So I go from being on top of the world to being told I'm going to drop dead. And my kids are 1 and 3. My spouse at the time is 27. So not exactly what I planned. So now I'm sharing this not to talk about cancer, but to try to tell you about the planning and, you know, how things were done. So when that happened, obviously the first thing was to hand over the company. And this is for you to reflect, right? When they say you have to, your KPI, one of your core KPIs is to have the ability for the next person to take over your job, right? That's normally one of the very important KPIs for senior management. I did my handover of my business one day before my chemo, and I'm saying day one, x-ray, day two, PET CT, day three, biopsy, day four, handover, day five, chemotherapy. So 2 days after I was diagnosed, I handed a 10,000 employee company in my hospital room in 3 minutes. Okay? Because I was told that if I didn't give 100%, it was game over. Right? And it was either that, or I had to say goodbye to my two little kids, who were 1 and 3, which I was not in a position to do. So just to start reflecting, even when it came to succession planning, right? We talk about, you know, you didn't hit on, you know, the planning. I created a foundation at the age of 27. So when I was 27, I already had the planning for something like this to happen, right? And so all I had to do was pick up the phone, call my lawyer, and say, this is the situation. Is the house in order? He confirmed yes. He spoke to my spouse at the time. He told her the house was in order. She had nothing to worry about. And she was to focus on me and not to worry about the rest. And he was a phone call away. Right? Now, are we ready? So, you know, Roger and I went, you know, Roger was the chairman at an event that I spoke at in October. And, you know, it was, you know, we say we love our family. And we care for our family, but are we actually bringing continuity or disruption? Mm-hmm. Right? We don't want to talk about death because from the culture, we invite death once we start writing the will, but three things are guaranteed, right? Tax, okay, for most of us, right? Death and change. And funny enough, actually sadly enough, we resist all of them, right? I'm just finishing writing a book on embracing change. I'm going to be running workshops with families on embracing change. Mm-hmm. Because it's inevitable. Right? We were just talking before we started about how many times will you have to reinvent yourself? I've done it 3 times, and I know in 3 years, number 4 is coming. And I've been in the game 28 years. So you guys, get ready. It's going to go way faster. So if you need, you probably need to reinvent yourself 15 times in this lifetime, right? So the entrepreneurship culture that they're talking about the adaptability, right? The ability to question and not be like, yes, 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 right? Is gonna be different. And for my own kids, right? What have I created? I have an entrepreneurship fund for my children, where they have seed capital to start 3 companies. Seed capital, okay? It's not obscene money, it's seed capital. Right? Which is actually the value of what my dad did for us. Now, unlike most family businesses, and I think this is where I want to share a little, is my dad did not give us investment money to start the company. My dad gave us a loan and did not ask for equity. This is very, very unlike normal family businesses. So he gave us a loan, 150,000 US in 1991. Now, it may sound like chump change, but it was not chump change. Okay, no, sorry, 200,000 US for Eastern Europe and 150,000 US for Hong Kong with a stop loss. The Hong Kong stop loss was 100, the European stop loss was 150. Because he said, if you can't figure it out, go back to school, maybe choose a better school next time. Obviously, no insult to Wharton. I went there too, and I know most of his family did too, but anyways, his wife's family at least. And so I wrote my GMATs before I moved to Hong Kong. And understand, when you talk about risk, I had never been to Hong Kong in my life. I landed here April 18, 1992. I stayed at the Royal Garden Hotel. The next day I was in China at the fair negotiating contracts. I had never been here. Okay, let's be very clear. And I thought it's going to be very cosmopolitan, very international, and no insult to the Chinese. And I came in, I'm like, whoa, where are the foreigners? Like, are you kidding me? Right? I mean, obviously, I wasn't living in La Kwe Phong, right? So, I mean, it was a shock, right? And talk about brutal learning. You know, in Wall Street, they talk about brutality, right? That, oh, it's the tough and whatever. Wall Street was kindergarten class compared to dealing with the Chinese, okay? And I'm Indian, all right? And when I say I'm Indian, I grew up with Jews, Indians, and Lebanese, okay? There weren't too many Chinese in where I was, okay? And trust me, the Jews and Lebanese are not exactly kindergarten students, okay? They're, you know, they used to joke with my dad, they go, you're a Lebanese Jew, and he's actually Indian, right? Telling him basically that, dude, you're the worst of the worst. So frugality, let's not even go there. Low key, like we were taught, when I started this company 5 years ago, I went to hire people. So the headhunter's like, I'm looking for you, I can't find you. I say, exactly. We're Gujarati, we're born to be 6 foot under, so when we drop dead, we just roll over, right? That's it, you just gotta, you know, just turn. But they didn't get it, they're like, wait a minute. And it's about low key. So for my kids, I've got this entrepreneurship fund, and I was with them, you know, my sons were visiting, they live in their boarding school in Switzerland, and I saw that and I go, wait a minute, what if you don't wanna start a family business? So what happens to the money? So my kids are now 15 and 17. I'm going to share stories of what I've discussed with my kids so that you just kind of, you know, talk about this whole, you know, conversation, openness, communication, because Roger knows better than me that most succession issues, 60% if I'm not wrong, are communication related, right? So, and 10% are trust related. 13 are financial related, right? So the money is not the problem. Right? The problem is the communication. So I saw, we were having lunch, and so I go, what do you think? He's like, well, I mean, it's been earmarked for us, so I guess, you know, we should get it, right? I'm like, okay, we'll think about it. Then I go, okay, what if you start the first company and you crush it? What about company two and company three money? He's like, well, I guess we don't need it. I said, okay, so you're okay that we give it to the next generation? He's like, yeah, sure. I go, what happens if you don't start the second company because you're flat, right? As in, you know, emotionally, whatever, right? Even though I set up what's called a health and well-being trust, where they automatically have mentors, coaches, I mean, the whole nine yards to support them, right? And he was like, okay, if the first one didn't work and I don't want to start the second one or the third one, then I guess maybe we should, you know, we should receive the money. Right? And these are the conversations, right? So another one, I give an example. So we were like debating with my spouse at the time. I said, okay, at what age should they get the money, access to money? So she was saying 25, and I wasn't willing before 30. And I just come back from Switzerland from my lawyer. And I said, so I'm sitting with my kids. My kids are 9 and 11 at the time. Okay, 9 and 11. We're putting them to bed. We put them to bed every night, you know, hug them, kiss them, whatever. And I said, so what do you guys think? So my older son's like, you know, Dad, you know, your time, our time, it's a different time, right? So, I mean, you know, we're a lot more aware, we're a lot more mature, you know, and so I think Mama's right, you know, 25. I'm like, okay. And then the little guy's silent, this is his style always, right? And then all of a sudden he goes, but wait a minute, Baba, how old were you when you started to handle $1 million? And I said, good point. I said, I was 25. He's like, yeah, you see? I said, yeah, but the difference is I earned $1 million. I didn't inherit $1 million. He's like, oh, okay. And I think we need to think about it, right? Then one day we were sitting, and you know, we were all sitting at a dining table, and I go, so guys, how should the allocation of assets be done? You know, if something happens to Baba, right? That's what they call me. And so my oldest son, so I go, should it be 50, Mama, 25, 25? Should be 1/3 each, like, what do you think? And we've always raised them as equal, right? So if I get a Herman Miller chair, everybody gets a Herman Miller chair. If I get a Tumi suitcase, everybody gets a Tumi suitcase. It's all the same. If I change my phone every 2 years, everybody gets to change their phone. All the same, you know, so my older son's like, so first the younger one, he goes, well, you know, it's okay, Mama gets more, right? He's trying to be a nice guy, right? Now at that time, he's 10, the other guy's 12, okay? 10 and 12. So the older one goes, yeah, but Baba, you've taught us that we're all equal, so obviously we should all get equal, right?
So here's your mom looking, right? And I'm like cracking up, but of course I'm trying to stay as
calm as possible. And I go, so what's your contribution? You said you deserve equal. What's been your contribution? All right? And obviously we talk from a conscious level, and he goes, well, I actually chose you to be my mama and baba. That's my contribution. So I was like, okay, this is a good conversation to have, right? But also remember that when the business took a hit, I would say our five holidays have become three. And it happened. So one day, every end January, I still have one of the businesses in Angola. So I receive a message on my phone, and it's like, I get a number, and it's, you know, we lost $1.8 million, right, overnight, okay? So I get this message, and every end January, it's in Angola, they do a tax structure change, and we lose our pants, okay? It's just always normal. But this time, it was much bigger. So I go back in the room, and I go, guys, we just lost, and I never use numbers with them, but this time I actually did. I said, we just lost $1.8 million, and tomorrow morning, we'll know the real story. So my kids are like, okay, that wasn't funny. So I wake up in the morning, and I find out that we've lost money in the majority of the places, and we're down to 45, 50 cents on the dollar, the whole company, right? So I go to the office, and, you know, I'm calm, because, you know, it is what it is, right? And then I come back the next evening, and I tell the kids, guys, we're going to have three holidays now, because we're 50 cents on the dollar, right? I mean, we can't afford five holidays, unless you want to earn it back. They're like, what? I said, yeah, I'm going to give you the scenarios, you give me the solutions, and if you give me the right solutions, then we get our holiday back. And I sat with them with a whiteboard, and they were 11 and 13. And we sat on a whiteboard, and I went category by category, because there's different categories in the business, and they actually found me the solution. Of course, I simplified it, right? And they found me the money, right? So talking about the Jewish way, right? Now, I'm not saying this is how it works, right? So we have families that we manage that have zero shares going to the daughters. So what they do is, the daughter's about to get married, right? They do a valuation of the company, and the valuation share of the daughter goes into a trust and is provided. Now, in the Muslim culture, half share to the daughter, full share to the son. Okay, so some are following that, some are not. Now we have another family that it's bloodline only, and everybody gets equal. Okay, including voting. And they're sitting on the board, they're doing all that, but they're not active in the business. They're very active in philanthropy. So it's kind of, they're getting there, but not on the business side, right? So if I look at my own dad, my brother has a daughter, right? And he's done it equally for the grandchildren. He's not differentiated, right? I don't have a daughter, so for me, I can't really give you an example. I would do it equally, but I don't have a daughter, so you can't count my, you know, so it's, you know, things are changing, you know, so when we ran the business, my brother would sit at the head of the table as the boss, right? Was he the actual active global CEO? The answer was no, but he was still respected because he was the elder one, okay? But that didn't mean that he ran the company. It was just the face that we talk about, right? It was still, you know, others running the company who were actually, so, you know, I don't want to give a picture where the South Asians are crazy like me. They have conversations at the age of 10 and 11 and 12 with their kids, whether their mama should get 50 or one third, right? I mean, I'm not saying that's the norm, but I think things are changing, right? That as we get, you know, today I had a family in town, and he was like, you know, I mean, his wife passed, and he goes, I need to tell my kids, because he doesn't have a family office. He goes, they won't know what to do. They won't know where the accounts are. They don't know anything. Mm-hmm. So he goes, how do I have this conversation? And his eldest kid just finished first year university. So it's, you know, so it's 19, 17, and 10. Mm-hmm. Now, how are you going to have the conversation? I said, well, you're going to have to delegate this to somebody that you trust. Because, you know, unless you've done it like I have, like my kids have met everybody. They've met all the bankers, all the lawyers. They've met, you know, all my crazy guys in terms of mind trainers, Ayurvedic masters, the whole nine yards, right? But his kids have met nobody. So you can't just all of a sudden one day go, okay, you know what? This is the situation, this is the deck, right? Like even in my own case, my spouse knew the lawyer, but didn't know the deck. When I say deck, I mean what is owned, right? Like what do we own, how much money, what the structure is, etc. She didn't know. My mom, today, even today, right, still has no clue what the wealth is, right? And it's incredible because they both sat in the lawyer's office next to each other in Hong Kong to sign the papers, and she had no clue what he did, like at all. And he did it in front of her. And he did completely different than her. I don't want to go into details, but completely different, right? And it was just amazing. So it's not, you know, to have the older generation communicate and clear the air is a lot more challenging than the new generation to have the conversation that needs to be had. But you know, I'll give another example, and then I want to make this an engagement. I want you to start telling me what triggered you, what you think works, doesn't work, why, what. So I'll give you one more example where a family, the older generation said, I was telling them we need to assign coaches, mentors, you know, a whole team for the next generation to really, really support the process. And the older generation said, no, we want them to go figure, right? Now, they themselves, the older generation, had to figure because they started from nothing, right? So they had to find their way, but their kids never had to do it. But when it came to helping themselves, right, in terms of everything, in terms of understanding relationships, right? What is masculine and feminine? Like, we all get into relationships. Do we have a clue? Many of us become parents. Do we have any training in parenting? But no, we need a license to drive a car, right? You need an MBA to get certain jobs, but to get married, you sign a paper. Because we, you know, it's. I had this chairman of a bank, of a huge family business, say to me, he goes, yeah, but it's animal instinct. And I actually wrote an article, which is going to come out next month. And I quoted him in it, obviously not his name. And I said, yeah, it's animal instinct. If we're able to be present and engaged and non-judgmental, right? If we're able to embrace and trust, right? But the minute we impose, we expect, and we judge, it's over. The animal instinct's gone. Animals aren't sitting there reflecting, oh, that guy did that to me last time, right? There's none of that, right? They're present now. They're doing everything now. And so I advised them, and they said, no, it's good. And you won't believe, last year, they had a board meeting. They walk in the board meeting. The next generation says, they want to start? It's a board meeting for money, right? It's business. Huge business, okay? They make, I don't know, a few hundred million dollars a year, right? And they're about to start, and the younger generation says, stop. And he's like, what happened? He goes, we as the next generation have decided that we're calling it a day. And the older generation almost fell on the floor. And nobody knew. None of the fathers knew. Okay, there's no mothers in the room, right? And they were like, excuse me? He goes, yes, we've decided that we are in too much pain. Okay, there's just too much pain. And we do not want to do this. We want to split the business up, right? It's five brothers. And this is how we want to move forward, okay? And then luckily, the same kid, after 15, 20 minutes said, we want to start a process in the room where we want to share the pain we've received or given to each other in this room. And they started that process, okay? And obviously the older guys were just like, holy shit, I hope this shit doesn't come in my direction, right? But of course it did, right? And what was unbelievable is the big boss wasn't there. He actually hurt himself, because this is what happens. When shit's rolling, you have physical manifestation. The guy didn't even make it to the board meeting, okay? Then they said, okay, you know what? We're gonna go on pause, because a lot of stuff came out and it felt really good. So they said, we're gonna go on pause and we're gonna have a board meeting in 3 months. And 3 months later, guess what they did? Because the old generation was not willing to clean their mess, they came in and they said, we're ready to stay together on the following condition. All you guys, give us your exit plan. You confirm your exit plan, we stay together. You don't, we split. And every one of them gave an exit plan, and the longest, who's like the brain of the company, has 2 years. And they're all out. So when we talk about communication, we talk about support, right? To me, Roger knows this, we're working on today the world's first health and well-being trust. I mean, we set the family health office, which does what family offices do for wealth, we do for health. And when I say health, I mean medical. I mean, so it's physical, mental, emotional, relational. because the real issues are on the other side. They're not necessarily just medical, right? And then today we're setting up. I mean, we'll have the article written and the structure done. We're working with lawyers to create a health and well-being trust, just like I've done for my own kids, right? That they should have access, right? To, you know, whether they want to understand that, you know, genetic predisposition to disease, they want, you know, medical teams, they want access to, you know, medical assistance, they want to have, you know, their eating and moving and sleeping and thinking and feeling assessed and improved and all of that, and then all the coaches, right? So these are the things, like, what is important, right? We talk about family business and family office, right? Is the family coming first, or is the business or the office coming first, right? If your own lives, right? Just think about it, right? I mean, I saw some of us eating some very interesting food when they walked in. I was like, wow, right? Are we eating with a return on ingestion, or are we just eating because we got to get by, right? So tell me, what triggered you? What felt, you know, what felt good? What felt ridiculous? In the last 15 minutes we have, I'd like to, you know, start a dialogue and not just have me monologue. I could go on forever, okay? But and tell you stories that you'll probably, you know, think is nuts. But I'd like to hear from you. So who has the first question? Any question? Any comment? He's looking. He's like, me?
I mean, I wasn't sure. Oh, no, it's interesting that you were prepared to sort of speak to your kids at that age. And I'm wondering if you had that from your parents, or is that something that you actually...
No, I mean, my dad was here a month ago, and we were talking about communication. And I said to him, I said, you know, the maximum I got out of you, look, he's a great, I don't mean to insult him, he's a great dad. He took us all over the world. We had the most incredible, you know, education, etc. But when it came to real conversation, I said, do you remember I used to poke you on your tummy? Right? I poke him on his tummy. This is, I'm between the age of 12 and 15, while he's reading a newspaper with a cigar or a pipe in his mouth. And his response was, hum. Right? The conversation took place at dining tables. Why? Because he had a lot of visitors. Okay, so he had a lot of, like I said, Jewish, Lebanese, and other people coming regularly. So he'd always have people coming in from overseas. I mean, like, interesting, look, he's at Rockefeller guys, Rothschild guys, I mean, crazy people, right? And twice a week, we would be entertaining either in or out of the house, and that's where dialogue would take place. So for example, when I got into Wharton, he actually called his buddy, he got into two schools, Carnegie Mellon and Wharton, what do you think? They're like, shut up and write the check. He had no clue. Literally, he had no clue. But he had the network, right? I remember the first time I went to Geneva, and I look at him like, Discount Bank of Israel? Like, are you kidding? Like, we're Muslims, right? And then Safra, I'm like, are you for real? He goes, listen, man, did you know what a Patek was, or an Audemars Piguet was? Or I know all this thanks to them, so don't start with me. So he learned from the Jews, right? So no, my father did not have. But again, remember, in 1986, when the hostile takeover happened, he did have the conversation that was needed. And he did ask, and he did respect it. And he did choose accordingly. So he didn't fight the way he would have if we were going to stay in the system. Okay, so he actually exited. Okay, he bought another company, right, because he's bored. But, you know, he did exit from that situation. Right, so no, I did not have, I did and didn't. You know, it's a mix. But I did not have the emotional communication. Right, today, tomorrow night I'm going to Switzerland to be with my kids. I mean, I hug, I kiss, you know, every day my kids in front of everybody. Like, if you see me in Hong Kong on the street, I'll be skipping with my two kids, and they're 15 and 17. They're not like 3 and 4, right? I do not have that, if that's what you're asking. Go ahead.
So you're trying to get a lot of information
and
to make your open...
Microphone, please.
So you are trying to engage a lot of people from the family business, right, to express their feeling. So my question is, if you have one specific person that is trying to get it, or is like you address them? I mean, because you have a lot of different people, and everyone is a different, right?
Yeah.
I mean, for example, I'm working in a specific company, and I will behave in a way, and my boss which maybe my father is a totally different person. So my question is there a specific family member that is in charge for doing that?
So basically, okay, so what you're asking is, okay, there's two things. One is, who's the one engaging the process?
Yes.
Okay, so in our case, it could be the patriarch or the matriarch, okay, that says, I want, yes, we focused most of our time and energy on the business and the money side of things. We have this incredible family office that manages all of that, tax planning, succession planning, estate planning, all nine yards. But yes, we haven't done what it takes to take care of the family side. Right? So it could be them, or it could be the CEO. Now, how does everybody engage? Very different. So each individual will come in with their own priority. Because remember, we're doing medical, then beyond medical is, like I said, basics, eating, moving, sleeping, thinking, feeling. And then the third is family dynamics, which is relationship with yourself, relationship within the family, and relationship with the community. So some may have medical issues, right? Some may have, you know, I want to improve their food, improve their drinking, improve their movement, right? So they will choose. So each family member will choose their own path because it's bespoke. There's no general plan, right? But the driver is either normally the patriarch, or the CEO, okay? And we're taking, like imagine, right? So if you're a large family and you want to understand genetic predisposition to disease, better do it together, right? And create a collective force to be able to deal with the fact that we are in control of nurture, which is 50% of the formula, right? So if we're in control of 50% or more, then let's do this together. But when you do it today, everything we do is done in silos, but there's no communication. And when there's no communication, right? Like today, we had this member that came, and she had the Beyond Medical had the notes from the DNA for health and nutrition, okay, nutrition and fitness. She had access to the Ayurvedic Master notes. She had access to the coaching notes. She had access to, you know, a number of things that she can use to leverage to have the conversation. But what is the reality, right? We talked about, you know, we're saying we ran, you know, I ran what was called a death cafe, okay, last year, October. It was a 2-hour workshop on death. You know, people were like, are you crazy, right? But what was it about? It was just about creating a safe environment where there's no judgment, no imposition, and no expectation. And if you create that safe environment, whether it's your father, whether it's your cousin, whether it's you, people will open up because they feel safe. But when it's not that space, it's shut down. Even I would shut down, right? Does that answer your question? Next question. Yes?
As far as I have to make by your thoughts on the constant need to change, to reinvent itself, and relation to your children, I'm wondering how you communicate that need to change and what to look for.
To my own kids?
Yeah.
Look, I've they've seen, right, all the changes that have happened with me, right? I'm now, you know, finalizing a book, I'm doing a lot of speaking, and things are starting to go to another level. And I just, you know, Jack Ma spoke, I was telling them at the World Economic Forum, and he was saying basically, if you want to compete with machines, you're heading for disaster, right? So what are going to be the qualities that are going to allow you, right, to not have to compete with machines, right? So for the kids, look, the kids are learning four languages, English, French, Spanish, Mandarin, in school, right? They're doing music. They're doing a lot of sports, right? They're in the mountains. We're at 1,300 meters up to 1,800 meters. So they hike, they go skiing. So there's, you know, the whole element of grit and resilience. They take some really crazy holidays with me where they're completely out of the comfort zone, whether it's food, culture, color, religion, and physical activity. But yes, I keep explaining to them what I just shared, right? That if I've had to reinvent myself already 3 times, and I can see the fourth one coming, it's the same thing that happened to you, but accelerated. So how are you going to understand that, right? So, you know, it's all the adventures they're having, right? Because it's really about resilience. But what is resilience? It's the ability to get back up, right? And that's why I asked the question, what if you What if you don't get up? That's why I'm setting up the Health and Well-Being Trust to support them when they fall down, right? But it's to be ready to fall down, because we're all going to fall down, right? It's a reality of life. So it's the one who stays in the game, right? It's consistency and persistency, right? So, you know, today everybody talks about, oh, I want to follow my passion. Great, but you better be good at it, right? Passion is good, but you got to be good at it. You can't have passion and suck at it. It's not going to make you, you know, whatever, popular, wealthy, I don't know, whatever, whatever's important, right? So it's finding that combination, and how do you find it? Like, look at me, right? What am I doing in the family health space? I'm not a doctor. I'm not a consultant. I'm not trained like him, right? I'm not. I'm a kindergarten student compared to this guy. Look, I'm being honest, right? But life gave me a kick so hard that I had to sit there and go, wait a minute, I better rethink, right? I mean, I just wrote the article, and in there it says, at the age of 13, they asked me, my dad's friend was sitting with my dad in front of me and said, what do you want to be? I said, part-time doctor, part-time businessman. What do you think was the truth? You think it was businessman? It was doctor. But because my dad drank, smoked, walked, talked, did whatever business, it's a default. I mean, I started my own business at 10 in school. It's to sell candies in school to buy train sets. 10. Right? And when we were in school, we used to come back. We had a company called Société Samedi Soir. That means Saturday night company. It was what? To party Saturday night. So basically it's money, and the mamas loved it, right? Because we used to be in the open market. They were like, oh my God, these guys are crazy. First of all, foreigners in a market where the ratio is 10,000 to 1. But of course we speak all the local lingo. And that's what we had the company for. So I actually said that, and look what happened. I end up with stage 3 cancer. I sell almost every company I have except Angola. I start taking care of my own family in terms of health, set up a family health office for my own company, and 5 years ago we set up the world's first, until today the only, family health office in the world. And we finished 5 years last Sunday, right? Did I choose that? Or did I allow life to present it, and I said yes, right? So this is what the kids are learning and seeing that, you know, and they say, everybody has the same opportunity, but what you see and what I see is completely different. Why? Because you are your limitation and I'm my limitation. I'm as open as I allow myself. And that's why I say embracing change is the name of the game. Sorry.
I got a question. Because when you did the comparative study, Chinese and Jewish people, I'm sure you negotiate a lot with Chinese and Jewish people. Tell us the differences and the similarities in negotiating with the Chinese and the Jews.
Okay, so yeah. Don't worry. I'm Indian. I'm Gujarati, so we're the 100-year play. So let me tell you, when I came here, the first year I got my ass handed to me, like I said, right? And after a year I sat with the Chinese guys. I said, guys, like, how the hell do you do this? Like, how do you just rip the shit out of a human being like that? I said, it's simple. You sit on the table and we watch. And we gauge whether you know your head from your ass. Right? But you sat on the table and you know the rules. There are no rules. Right? So if you sit on the table, you take responsibility for sitting on the table. We do whatever's needed. And they just cut your legs off. Now, Jewish people, I think we have to be very careful where they're from. The Israeli Jew is a different ballgame, and it's 100% a different ballgame, right? Now, you go to the garment district. I used to be in the garment business, right? So you go to the garment district in New York, and you go to negotiate. You walk in. You can give him gold. He's going to chuck the garment in your face. Now, if you're going to go whimper, and it's over. The guy's testing, right? So it's all a poker play, right? It's how long can you stay in the game, right? Now, with the Chinese, the part that's really hard, no emotion. Like zero. Try to read them, forget it. So I said, I've been here now 23 of the last 26 years. Trust me, I am no competition. Okay? Because I show emotion, they show none. So I'll give an example. So I go to trade fairs, and I go and I'm sitting with, you know, sorry to say, and I know there's Westerners in the room, but when it comes to negotiations, it's a different ballgame. Okay? So we sit there and I say, this is the price. And that's it. And we do it because we have a computer. It takes 2 minutes. Done. And the guy's like, you know, I don't know, whatever. And then I have, you know, all women working for me, actually. I have no men in most of my operations, okay? And sorry for the men. But, and so they look at this Chinese girl, right? Young, you know, you can't tell. Chinese, you know, young means you could be 50 or 20, right? It's like, you know, for the white guy, he has no clue, right? Sorry, dude. And so she's smiling, whatever. And so he thinks, you know, he's going to get a better deal from her. And I'm like, sure, you know, negotiate. And what's the difference? She's smiling, and she ain't going to budge. Like, she ain't going to move 1 cent, even if she sat there for 6 days. And then I come back an hour later, I say, please, please, sit, because there's no emotion coming out of there other than a smile. With me, at least, there's some, right? So it's, you know, the Chinese, for me, till today, look, if you ask me in terms of supplier in the world, I pick China number one any day, because there's no story, there's no BS, you know, they don't sit there and go, yeah, it's okay, and then they don't do it. No, if it's okay, it's okay, if it's not, it's not, okay? So they're the most consistent, the most persistent. I don't inspect cargo anymore. I mean, I work with them eyes closed. So if I have to move 100% of business there, I move it in, okay? Like, without even blinking, right? Other countries, India, Pakistan, don't even start. South America, oof, let's not even go there. Europe is kind of like, you know, depends what part of the, or Europe you're dealing with, right? So consistency, persistency-wise, no issue. Negotiation-wise, look, we've learned how to play the game, right? We you know, we're very transparent. We work open books, okay? We choose our suppliers very well, right? But for the Jewish guys, look, they're very sharp, very quick, okay? But very different. So I grew up with the North African Jews, okay? And my dad, the Moroccan, the Algerian, that's a very different Jew. But when we operate in Eastern Europe, the Eastern European Jews, very strong. Like, when I say very strong, very, very hard. Like, you know, talking wise, like I said, the guy will throw the garment at you, the guy will treat you like crap. Like, we have real estate, you know, and we sit, and our largest tenant is a Jewish guy, and I will never go to the meeting. Like, no way. Because I probably either throw him out, or I don't know what I'll do, right? Because they're just, it's not what you want to deal with, right? So I don't mean, you know, I'm giving you examples of the toughness. But what you have to look at is the long-term play. Once you're in, you're in. All right, so I grew up with a lot of Jewish people because, you know, that's what was in Africa, and these are all long-term players. You know, 50-year, 100-year position, they're there. I know you talked about liquid assets, okay, but I think, I mean, I can't say that is the original way that they want to be able to move out, but same thing with India, right? So let's take India. So if you take India, you take a Gujarati, right? It's a 100-year game. There's no today. It's all today for 100 years from now. Now you take a different kind of India, a Sindhi, it's today. Tomorrow is irrelevant, right? So the majority of Indians here who I used to compete with are Sindhis, and they're my friends. But that's what it is. They say today is real, tomorrow is fiction, right? And so you can't, I don't think you can just, you know, like, it's the same thing. In Pakistan, you go to the guy in Karachi, he's not as educated as the guy in Lahore. The guy in Lahore is artistic, and their probably father went to Harvard, and, you know, whatever. The Karachi guy, father didn't even know how to spell Harvard, right? But that's where all the business is. Same with Bombay and Delhi, same thing. So I don't think we can, I don't want to generalize, right? But the difference between, I think that the Jews show more emotion when it comes to negotiation, but that doesn't mean it's real. Maybe drama, like I said, chucking bloody garment at you is not exactly real emotion. The Chinese will show nothing, right? I'm talking about the guys who want to play ball, not, you know, so that's my experience, and we're kind of confused in the middle.
But by the way, Wharton, most of the students are Jewish.
Yeah, I mean, even the professors at the time, remember there was a couple of Indians at the time, now of course it's a different ballgame, yeah. Right? It's a complete change. So, I don't know, I mean, look, if you know, look, at the end of the day, no matter what the comparative, these are the players, right? I mean, you look at the world today, you look at leadership today, right? It's the reality, right? You've got the Jews, the Chinese, the Indians, these are the guys, you know, because they did what we did talking about, right? They're frugal, right? The joke used to be always, right? You have a Mercedes and somebody's driving it, it's a Chinese guy, an Indian guy, and, you know, whatever, another white guy, you know, not Jewish, but another white guy, who's the richest guy, right? You can do the debate, right? It's definitely not the last guy, right? Because they believe in lease, they believe in mortgage, we don't even know what that means, right? What's a lease? What's a mortgage thing? We're, you know, we're prehistoric, we sign with our thumbs, right? Cash and walk away, right? So this is, the leveraging isn't there, right? In the old school, but then you don't get to, you know, a different play, right? So I think it's, you know, things are changing. I mean, the communication you're referring to, you know, it's not normal. I'm not saying it's normal, the conversation I have with my kids, okay? But I think slowly people are opening up to it.
Awesome.
Okay, last question. Yes.
You mentioned you set up your foundation on trust at 27.
Yeah.
Those were just after you got married with your kids?
No, I was before I got married because I was. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so what? I totally agree it's the right thing to do. Yeah. It's a bit early. You know, most people don't do it, and even actually, when people are in the 40s or the 50s, it's actually very difficult to come up with something that you are totally happy with because there's so many scenarios, right? So, what if I pass away? What if my wife passed away first? What if we
no, I have no wife, no kids.
Yeah.
Okay, so I created the scenarios and prepared for them. And remember, when you do anything of that sort, you revisit it every year.
Exactly, that's why I asked you, how often?
Every year, at least every year. Now I'm in Switzerland, so I can revisit what I want, right? Between Hong Kong and there. But you will revisit it every year and tweak as the situation works. Okay, I think we're out of time.
Yes, maybe I'll just summarize. I think you mentioned a very good point. It's actually very difficult for us to generalize, you know, the differences and similarities among different nations, different ethnic groups, even China, you know. But the people from North and South are actually very, very different. But what we're trying to do is really to find some, you know, unique differences or obvious differences that, you know, different ethnic groups can learn from other ethnic groups, and that's our main research motivation for this. So let us, you know, give Faisal a big applause for his sharing.
Okay, one, two, three.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I know I got one.